Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Insider, brought to you, just for a change, by Vanishing Ink. This week, we're lucky enough to have not one, but two magicians on the show today. Between them, they've been on loads of television shows, Conan, Magic for Humans, One Fism, fooled Penn and Teller, and are awfully, awfully existential. It's the hosts of Two Magicians, One Mike, Nick Paul and Simon Coronel. How are you both?
Oh, thank
great
you.
Great to be here. Wait, you were on Conan?
Me and my dog did a magic trick on Conan.
I did not know that.
So my research for this podcast is better than your knowledge of your friend.
Well, what's so great is
that
like...
That would not be unusual.
When our credits are combined, my career is much more impressive. So thank you very much for that.
Happy to help.
I helped duct tape things on Magic for Humans and was on Conan briefly, and you fooled Penn and Teller and won FISM, so that's great.
Well, you know. I mean, won at FISM. There's a difference. Yeah. I didn't win it.
Okay.
I won prizes. Anyway.
It's a short show. Origin stories. You've got 19 seconds each. Simon first.
Was 18, going to university, studying psychology and software engineering. There was a magic club. I had no prior experience. I joined. I got hooked.
Ooh,
boom.
Nick,
Eight seconds. My dad's a ventriloquist. I kept doing magic because my mentors were magicians. And then I realized when I went to theater school, I didn't want to be an actor anymore. And I just kept doing magic. And now I still do.
See? Efficiency.
Why did you start your podcast?
I started my podcast... I originally started back in like 2012, and it was before there were other magic podcasts, so I thought it was kind of like a niche thing, and then everybody started doing magic podcasts, so I kind of diverted it as a way to meet people, and especially when I moved to LA, it was super helpful. That's how I met Simon. Well, I knew you through our buddy John Armstrong, but we did an interview and really hit it off, and I just kind of used it as my own selfish way to make friends, and it's worked out.
That's a good reason. What do you think, apart from lots more magic podcasts happening, what do you think's changed over the years of your show since you've been doing it?
Well, ever since Simon got on, it became the existential podcast because that's just how his brain operates. before that, it was just kind of interviews and, it was no different than I think any other comedy podcast that I was listening to. And now we become deeper without even realizing it sometimes.
Yeah. I mean, the way I describe it to friends is that I accidentally have a magic podcast now because it very much absolutely began as Nick's podcast. And I still really think of it as way more Nick's than mine because he started it. He does most of the actual work. I just rock up and talk about whatever I'm thinking about, which seems to sometimes work out. And that's sort of one of the biggest shifts where people kept coming up to me going, hey, I love your podcast. And I was like, well, it's not my podcast. I'm just on it a lot. And then about a year ago now, we decided to officially make it our podcast.
Mm-hmm. Well, it became when we did Franz Ferrari's House of Magic, and we were just like to get the stress out and to have kind of group therapy sessions. Once a week, we would just record for an hour. And that suddenly got popular. And when we got back to LA after 3 months of doing that, we're like, oh, we should probably keep doing this because it's therapy for us.
Yeah.
So.
Something about the formula seems to be working for at least some people.
I don't know why. It doesn't make any sense.
Hey.
What have you learned doing it, do you think?
I've learned to be more positive and not throw people under the bus because people have feelings. And you forget people listen to this. I don't know. What about you, Simon?
God, it's a good question. I don't know if I've... I don't think I've grown as a character.
Simon's arc as a character has yet to happen. The sitcom. We're still in the pilot episode of Simon's character.
I have learned a lot about the actual production details that go into podcasts, and that's mostly through watching you do it all. It's fascinating because I have very little kind of audio engineering background. I do a lot of video stuff. But, just the details of microphones and editing and all that stuff. We've also learned that it's not a good idea to do podcasts over a choppy phone connection with a long delay. That was the over-over episode.
Yeah,
it doesn't work. Don't do that.
We've done episodes where he's in Antarctica. We're on opposite sides of Mexico. Often we're on cruise ships and we try to put out two episodes a month on the 1st and 15th. That's the goal. And sometimes we are nowhere near each other in the world. And it becomes an editing nightmare in GarageBand of me just like taking out these long gaps and us talking over each other. So that has not been fun, but I think it makes it more interesting when, hey, I just saw some penguins today, or hey, you know, I'm in the Caribbean. So it changes, kind of gives us a little bit different of a perspective of how to talk about things.
Sure. Nick, you were involved in the quite excellent Magic for Humans. How did you get that gig and what was the experience like?
Yeah, I just finished working on season 3 with them. Basically, it was I moved to LA and a friend of a friend said, you need to, you know, get to know Justin Willman. And I did. I reached out to him. We got coffee. We hit it off and we just kind of kept in touch. And I found out they were, you know, doing the first season. Well, this is like 2.5 years ago now. And I just emailed him and said, hey, you know, if you need any help, I'd love to be a part of it. And he brought me on the team. And then when I couldn't do any of season 2 because I was traveling, and then season 3 came along and they brought me back on the team. And, you know, it was just one of those things of just networking and getting to make friends with people in the community. So I think I spent so much of my career just emailing and bugging the crap out of people, but really it just... Living in LA, especially working with Simon so much, I see Simon gets so much of his work from people going, oh, you know Simon? Yeah, I know Simon. Cool, we should work on this project.
Yeah.
And it's very old school Hollywood in that way. And you kind of really can't explain that. I couldn't comprehend that until I moved to LA and started getting work from just chatting with people at the castle or just, you know, having a drink with people. And projects like that just happen here.
I think that's universal across the industry. Most people get their work through. Someone knows them, knows they're good. A direct recommendation is always going to be more powerful than even a great resume.
Let's talk about the Fool Us. The Three Fly is a lovely, lovely piece of magic. The timing is something I've not seen done before that way, the tension and the relaxation.
Yeah.
How did you develop it?
It was inspired, I mean, it began as every other Three Fly, right? Because you have the Three Fly lineage of, you know, Kenner's inspired so-and-so's inspired so-and-so's. And, I mean, Lee Ashes is the one that I kind of worked on. But, I mean, it's significantly changed since then in a whole bunch of ways. The back-and-forth flow of the misdirectional element of, you know, the idea basically to counterintuitively do Three Fly where you don't notice the moments happen, as opposed to focusing on the visuals. That actually came from a guy I knew back in Melbourne, Australia about 15 years ago called Chris Shing. And you won't find anything on him if you Google him. He doesn't really do magic anymore. He's a medical doctor. Haven't spoken to him for years. Hope he's doing well. And he was just a virtuoso coin magician back again, like 15, nearly 20 years ago now. And he was working on a Three Fly and it had one phase in it that had that sort of, I like to call them open misdirection moments. And, you know, Tommy Wanda has that great appearance of the egg in that card trick that just appears on the table without you realizing it. I remember being inspired by David Stone has a few moments. There's like a coin matrix routine he does where you sort of suddenly realize the coins appeared on the table without you noticing it. The famous Amar's third Cups and Balls, the ball appearance on top of the cup is another one like it. And I just always love those moments. And Chris, this guy who, you know, has long sort of departed from the world of magic, was the first one I saw ever apply that to a beat in a Three Fly. And I asked him, hey, would you mind if I kind of, you know, use that beat? And he's like, yeah, cool, go for it. And so over the next, honestly, about 7-8 years, I just played around with Three Flies and different handlings and eventually found ways to kind of make that concept work for every beat. And it was so much work. It's probably the single thing. I literally, every phase in that routine, I have at least 3 or 4 different kind of options in how the beats work and how the flow works. I have like 3 very different endings for how to handle the last coin. None of the last chip. I'm not completely happy with any of them yet. They're just sort of, you know, the least worst I've yet come up with. I still don't consider it a finished routine at all. It's really like one of my babies I've been crafting forever and really trying to. And then I notice sometimes I get worse at it. Because I've forgotten like the tiny micro details of the pacing, and I suddenly notice it's not hitting as hard, and I have to go back and watch videos of myself and go, oh yeah, that syllable was one stress longer before I look upwards, and I've forgotten about that. Yeah,
I experienced that a lot when we were in China, because we did like 300 shows or whatever it was, and you would, something you've done 1,000 times, you're like, why didn't that work as well? And then you realize, you miss a tiny little beat, a tiny moment that just kind of throws the thing under the bus. So. Yeah,
and particularly in that routine where it's sort of the core beats in the four phases of it.
We were chatting, you have a couple different ways you end it too, which I think is interesting.
Yeah.
You don't know how you're going to end it until like you're in that moment, which
and
is pretty cool.
I'm still sort of searching. That's the biggest sort of... I'm now finally really pretty happy with most of the initial beats, but the ending is still... every time I do it, I'm slightly irritated at it. And I still switch between the different ones I've got. I'm still feel there's probably a perfect one out there I haven't figured out yet.
Nick, I've seen your silent act on the castle. I assume that was created for kind of the shit work and foreign audiences. But before that, you're a funny comedy magician with lots of gags and jokes and a tight script. How hard was it for you to develop the silent act, and what were the challenges you encountered?
I studied mime with a mentor of mine in like 2006, and then I moved to Orlando and wanted to be a magician at Disney. And when I had that audition booked, I kind of had in the back of my, I had done certain kind of silent magic shows with my mentor and in other capacities. So in the audition, I just put together a completely silent routine, and they went for it. They liked it, and I eventually, you know, got a contract with Disney because it was different. I was so obsessed with like doing that and needing to be different and needing to, I think Simon gave me the best advice. He's like, if the most interesting thing about your show is that you're not talking, it's probably not very good. And
did I say that?
That's me butchering it. That's you, like, that's me probably making it more negative. It meant to be encouraging. It was an encouraging thing, but I thought a lot about that. And, I was trying so hard to kind of move away from standard talking comedy magician. And then about a year ago, like I'd still done talking shows on ships, but it was really rocky because I was so used to doing, I had done over 800 silent shows at Disney World over the 3 years I was there. So getting back into talking, it was a bit of a challenge, but now I'm kind of obsessed with it. I script out the show, and I now have transitions in and out of silent stuff, and it's getting stronger, and it still has a way to go, but I now feel more comfortable talking again. It was weird not doing it for a while, but I appreciate you saying that because, yes, so much of my instinct is to riff with the audience and comment on what's happening in real time. That's just my improv training kicking in. So not being able to do that when doing silent shows is tricky.
It's funny because I'm the total opposite. I am desperately in love with the idea of being able to do a complete like 1 hour silent show. And I've been working on being able to do that for years, but I'm definitely not there yet.
It's still a stronger, if we do like a local LA set here at one of the shows we always do, or like when Jack... I did the Palace with Lucy Darling and Stuart McDonald in June, and Jack Goldfinger, the booker, said, all right, I'm going to book you, but you have to do silent. Like, he told me I couldn't do talking stuff, and I was a little bit, you know, pissed, but I was actually, it's good to have a challenge and, you know, a set of rules placed on you, and that's kind of where the silent stuff came from. It was nice to go, okay, I can't talk, how am I going to do this mind reading routine? And I came up with a way to do mind reading without talking, and it's good to have challenges set on you like that. And my instincts, you know, kicked in right away when I had to do 24 odd shows in June at the castle, not talking. And that was the first time I hadn't done a talking show in a while. So it's good. And I do kind of default to that a lot of the time. Yeah. If the talking stuff isn't working, I'll go immediately into silent guy. And, I don't know. It's weird how certain instincts work and others don't.
How important is creativity in your magical performances for both of you?
Yeah, it's kind of, I'm over the past couple of years kind of just been obsessed. If, you know, if I'm doing something, I mean, this doesn't translate at all to my close-up stuff because my close-up is very, you know, basic and, you know, very similar to the way I learned it from other performers or videos or whatnot. But my show, I'm kind of obsessed with making, if it's a standard trick, making it different in some way. And I think you should strive to put your own stamp on something. Even, like, I do multiplying bottles. Everybody does multiplying bottles. But I think the way I do it is my own character, my own style. You know, I'm not trying to toot my own horn. But I think you should, if you're putting something in the show, it adds something that is of your own voice or lack of voice, you know, in my case.
So what's your process for coming up with that? So, okay, so you want to do multiplying bottles. So what's your process to put your stamp on it?
I think when I originally started that, I created some sort of a scene. You know, it was originally called like Drinks for One, and I was having just like dinner with myself. So in that case, it was a setting. You know, I needed a beginning, middle, and end. But it doesn't have to be that extreme. You know, it just you know, something that I have a notebook in my phone, and if an idea pops in the head, I'll immediately jot it down. I think that's the biggest thing I've learned from guys like listening to Penn Jillette's podcast. He was talking about he's such a big Bob Dylan fan, and he used to think Bob Dylan was this genius. And well, he still does, but it was such a revelation to him when he learned that Bob Dylan kept a notebook, and he wasn't just showing up in the studio and the stuff was pouring out. This is like years of work. He's like, okay, let's reference what, oh, that's an idea. And so for me, it's like over the past 2 weeks, I just spent, we both do a lot of ships, and you need 90 minutes of material, two different 45 minute shows. And I, a couple weeks ago, did my B show, and it just wasn't as strong. So I just spent a lot of time nitpicking it and going, okay, what ideas have I had over the year that I can tweak and change stuff? Even if the tricks, like the Build-A-Orange I do or the balloon animal restoration I do is super standard stuff in that show. But it's like, okay, how does my voice come through, and how is it going to be different? So if somebody sees it, they don't feel like they're seeing the same trick that's 100 years old. So.
Yeah, it's I think I've been thinking a lot recently about this, about, because I used to, back in sort of the FISM days and all that jazz and magic competitions, I used to, this about 10 years ago, I used to often go on rants about how I think often magic competition judge panels have an excessive conceptual boner for originality, often at the expense of quality.
Yeah.
You often see quite mediocre, very original acts given higher marks than really good, less original acts. And without being hack about it. And it's sort of I used to sort of go on vague rants about this. And I think there is, and like many things, I've got a more nuanced view now. And at the moment, I'm thinking a lot about the difference between creativity, originality, and novelty.
Mm.
We've talked about this quite a bit in the podcast. A lot of these get sort of, I think, lumped together by people who aren't really fully thinking it through, because creativity, in a literal sense, to create something, doesn't necessarily have to imply originality. It often does. Those two often correlate very strongly, but just building something, making a thing, doesn't have to be original. You could create something that it turns out is also something else someone's come up with. That was still creative, and that's still worth celebrating. It's a good thing, craftiness and everything. Then you have originality being the first to do something new that's never been done before. But then novelty is really actually what I think most audiences are looking for. Because, so, do you remember there was that thing, there was an act somewhere that went around viral about balancing these giant palm tree branches, this amazing balancing act, like slowly balancing these palm branches one on top of each other, one at a time, until it became this almost impossible looking balancing tree thing. Look it up, it's amazing.
Okay.
And I saw that live at an absinthe like show in Australia about 10 years ago. And I was just transfixed. I was captivated. I'd never seen anything like it. It was impressive and it was completely original. Until over the next year, I saw like three other people do exactly the same act.
Right.
And I don't know who stole from who, or maybe they bought it, or maybe it's actually 100 years old. I actually have no idea. But the second time round, I'm like, oh, this old thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it doesn't matter if something's original, because what an audience wants actually is novelty. Novelty is the subjective experience of perceiving originality, even if it's not original. Right? Because say you've never seen Invisible Deck before.
Uh-huh.
The first time you see it, that is absolutely as novel as a genuinely original act, even though it's not.
Yeah.
I don't have any real conclusions from this, but I think it's really it's useful to break this down into what is the audience experiencing versus what is the literal truth of the originality of the thing versus, like, are you just being creative and getting stuff done, which is good and worthwhile?
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting, because, like, obviously at the castle, you've got audiences that are used to seeing magic, and on ships, probably not so much. But for most gigging magicians, they're going out to people that probably have not seen magic close up before.
Yep. Absolutely.
So therefore, can't they just do all like classic things that are brilliant, because you know they're it's going to be novel for
it's,
those.
I think that's why exactly. It's so common to see corporate magicians and college magicians doing the same stuff for that reason. You don't really have that kick in the butt. And actually, working ships, and I think Simon's gone through this too, people see a lot of magic. So it is kind of a nice, good kick.
I imagine.
Yeah,
exactly. A lot of Professor's Nightmare, Bill and Lemon, Bowling Pool production. It's this joke that you could just have the locker of the magician's props. You don't even bring your stuff. We have all the things you need.
Yeah.
However, we're witnessing, that was a, I forget whose that was. That was a cruise director's joke that was very funny. But we're witnessing an interesting time in the world right now where it's weird because you have, and this is where I think above all else, being really aware of and present with your audience is the most important thing because every audience is so different. On a cruise ship, you can actually expect they've probably seen a lot of stuff that most people haven't. But more and more audiences see more and more magic than ever before since maybe vaudeville nowadays.
Yeah.
In 2019, a lot of people are seeing magic on TV, magic on YouTube, magic on all the Got Talent shows. And we're seeing a lot of people just non-magic fans, just random normal members of the laity out there who are like, oh yeah, that fucking Linking Ring trick, I'm over it. And so sort of the classics, quote-unquote, are kind of often now overdone, even at the general public level. But that's still very subjective. Every audience is very different. I don't really have any conclusions on this. I've just been thinking a lot about it. Put it this way, it doesn't hurt to be original. If you can be original and good, then that's win-win. That's the best of all worlds.
I love... Every once in a while, when I do my A show, it's more original material. People will come back and say, I've seen a lot of magic, and I've never seen any of that. And that's, like, the biggest compliment. And it's not striving to be original, but it's striving to make it feel original. Because I guarantee half the stuff in there aren't original ideas and aren't original tricks. I'm flipping it enough to the audience doesn't realize they're seeing something that they've already seen before in many cases.
I think of it, and it's not a completely fair analogy, but I think of it a lot like being a chef, in that if you're a chef, there's only so many meats, so many vegetables, there's so many baking, boiling, frying, steaming, but if you're an original chef, you find ways to create new original culinary experiences out of this toolkit. And in magic, you can vanish a thing, make a thing appear, read a mind. There's only so many things, but you can take these things in so many different, gloriously original, novel, creative directions. And I think it's, because the other thing is, even if you don't need to, if you can just go out to most gigs and do Invisible Deck, and people go, whoa, that's the most, that I've never seen. What's his name? Who was it? It broke my heart. It really hurt me and a lot of people. Did Cartoon on Britain's Got Talent.
Yeah.
And I think Simon Cowell said that's the most original thing I've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And that gave me a proper existential crisis for quite a while of like, well, what's the effing point now? Is that's it? It's just a race to do the good things and be the first to do the good thing on the thing. But the thing is, every now and then, and reasonably frequently, having something original and creative will pay off because you never know who's in the crowd. You never know who's watching you. Who does see a lot of magic and knows their stuff, who will go, oh, that's cool. Mm-hmm. And you will get an offer or an introduction or whatever that you never would have got if you hadn't been doing good and original material. It's got to be both. And I would say good first, original second, but like it's very close. It's almost a tie.
I got trapped on this. I was on a cruise ship for 2 weeks, and we were supposed to record Monday, and I got trapped on 2 extra days because we couldn't stop in this port. So I offered to do a third different show. It was just all close-up stuff, and it's all, ambitious card-to-wallet, Rubik's Cube stuff, just nothing original at all in that repertoire, just stuff I do strolling. And it's funny how many people came up to me and gravitated to that the most because there is this new craving in culture because people are seeing so much Fool Us that they want to see close-up sleight of hand. And so I was doing a close-up show projected on a screen for 500 people, and you could just feel just people coming up and really appreciating it. So people are seeing a lot of magic, and even though I wasn't doing any like super original tricks in that set, they were appreciative of the skill that goes into it. So I think that's kind of a positive thing that's happening right now.
Oh, I think like with most things, the real conclusion is there is no one thing you can say about it.
Sure.
It's not like, this is what matters. That's what most people gravitate to, and that's never right. It's never one thing. There's no one rule. There's no one unifying principle. It's just really important to think about all these things, bear them all in mind, and then make intelligent choices, always eventually based on keeping the audience as satisfied as possible while being ethical and legal.
That's always legal.
That's it. And legal. It's important to mention that.
Show title.
Thank you.
Let's talk about your new thing, talking about original and creative. Often on your podcast, you say you're working on some secret thing and can't discuss it. But on this podcast, you're working on a thing and you can discuss it. Tell us about Magic Showdown.
Magic Showdown / Magic Smackdown until we get sued.
/ Improv Magic Smackdown.
Yeah, it has three names that we can't really decide on. Simon and I and John Armstrong came up with this idea for a Fringe show a couple years ago where the audience votes in real time on their phones for their favorite magician in rounds, and it's basically Whose Line Is It Anyway meets
Fool Us meets Fool American Idol.
That's the log
line. High concept blurb.
That's the pitch we're
communicate it to the buyers.
To be selling. And it's been fun. We just did a run of shows and at a theater in Indiana, and I think we finally figured it out. We've been doing it about 3 or 4 years on and off, or two and a half years on and off, and we finally figured out, okay, these rounds and the way the audience is involved and, you know, what things work and what don't. So it's been fun.
I think actually to briefly tie this back to the previous topic, I think that's what one of the things people don't realize about the creative process is just how many false starts it takes.
Yeah.
Like how many to get one great idea. Like, you know, Penn's myth about Bob Dylan thinking, oh, it just comes out. No, to get one great bit, there's probably, for me, about 20 bits that just never really make it into the show, that I work on intensely and try out, and they're original and creative but not good, so they fall by the wayside. And then 1 in 20 ends up being good enough to, yeah, that's a thing now. So, yeah, again, we've been working on this show for about 3 years. Each time it's changed significantly. We keep just trying different things. We don't know if it's going to work. We have a hunch it might. About half the time, maybe a third of the time, it's not terrible, and then we keep doing the things that were good and taking out the bits that were bad, trying different things. And finally, after about 3 years, it's really starting to take a good form that we're actually really happy about, which is exciting.
If you're near Albuquerque, New Mexico on December 7th, come see it at the Santa Ana Star Casino and Resort.
You can tell we have catapulted to the big time.
Hey, man. We end the show with four quick-fire questions, gentlemen. We will do this in the order of Nick, then Simon, for everyone, okay?
Okay.
Favorite pizza topping?
I used to say pineapple, but then people got angry at me, which I still like it, so now I just say cheese.
Okay.
Everything they have except for olives or spicy things.
Okay.
Put it all on there. Just load it up.
Favorite movie?
My go-to is always Hook.
Ooh, I wouldn't know how to pick one. There are so many, but the first one that springs to mind. I'm only allowed one. In that case, The Matrix. It's just a perfect analogy for perception and reality.
Actually, I changed mine. That Thing You Do by Tom Hanks.
Okay.
That or Primer. Actually, Primer. Forget. Screw The Matrix. That's so mainstream. I'm original. It's Primer.
I was going to say, I was not very impressed by that answer.
Yeah, Primer's better. I was more obsessed with Primer than any other movie.
Pretty brilliant.
I went to a deep rabbit hole on that movie.
Favorite person or people that make music?
I like all music.
No, not acceptable.
You have to pick one for the sake of the question.
If it's very mainstream and not original, original is the wrong word, but my wife and I love the band Bare Naked Ladies. We're big B&L fans.
How do you pick one? But I think one picked me about a year ago. You know, you hear a song that you like, you don't know who it's by, you Shazam it to find out where it is so you can download it. I had an awkward experience, 4 songs in a row over the course of a month. I'm like, who's this by? This is a good song. Taylor Swift, every goddamn time.
Oh, there's a reason she's great.
It was confronting. Mm-hmm. It was really confronting.
And finally,
I just want to see Simon in a Target go, who is this?
Yeah,
who's standing next to
song.
A big cutout of Taylor Swift? She's good.
It's got quite a good beat. Who is this?
Shazam again? Taylor again?
I am feeling 22.
There's nothing more existential than a gentleman of your age being into Taylor Swift, man.
Yeah, I know. It's confronting. I'm questioning many things. Savage Garden were always my spirit animals way back.
Were they Australian?
Yeah.
I had their CD. I had their CD in the 90s.
They spoke to my heart in high school.
Who would you rather fight, one massive Andy or 100 tiny Joshuas?
That's funny. That's the duck-sized horse or horse-sized ducks, isn't it?
I immediately pictured just punching a whole bunch of tiny Joshuas. No particular reason. He's a great man. Tiny Joshuas.
If you're actually planning to win the fight, you always go the many small things. It's much easier to beat many small opponents than one large opponent.
It's the Malcolm Gladwell book, you know, the one he did about...
killing 100 people.
No, what's the one? The guy with the slingshot. He hits the
David
the,
and Goliath.
Thank you. The title of the book. He said that doesn't make any sense because Goliath had the advantage.
Yeah, massively.
The whole time.
Yeah.
This whole story makes no sense.
Yeah. Yeah, the duck-sized horses thing is always ridiculous. It shows no one's actually thinking it through if they pick the one big thing.
I love how he said short answers and we still went existential.
That's good. Quick fire. The clues were all there. This is meant to be a 30-minute Josh's show.
Tiny Josh's.
It says in the log, it says in the description, you edit it down, so good luck.
Yeah, I've got to cut this down to 30 minutes and we're at 50. So,
The struggle is real.
I'll have to somehow make you look
who knows
less existential. Should people want to keep up with your antics, can they follow you on their social media in some manner?
The Instagram for Two Magicians is at Two Magicians, I believe, or Two Magicians One Mic. I honestly can't remember. Just search that. I'm Nick Paul Magic.
And whatever app you have, I'm Things by Simon in it. Boom. On everything.
Gentlemen, thank you so much. It's been an absolute blast. I've enjoyed that very much indeed.
Back at you.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Until next time.